Hello, I'm here with Steve Hochberg. He is the Chief Market Analyst for Elliott Wave International, and he's going to be speaking at the Money Show here in San Francisco. And Steve, thanks for taking the time to conduct this interview. I've got some questions for Steve. He's been associated with the Elliott Wave Financial Forecast, of which I've been a subscriber for quite some time. Really enjoy his work. But I've got some questions for him that I think sometimes they've addressed it a little bit in the in their publication, but I also want to try to create some sort of relation, some things that I've discussed within my book itself. First, Steve, I do subscribe to socioeconomic theory, even probably before I started reading about it, in your publication. I also spent a lot of time studying cycles, did a lot of commodity trading many years ago.
Sure.
In my book, I hypothesize that one component of social mood is generationally based. The influential generation of our time has been the baby boom generation, and they ushered in, the greatest credit cycle in the history of the world, right? And I'll peg that along with the stock market bottom, an important bottom that you guys have identified as well, about 1982. You guys have another one, 1974 as well. The successor generation, my generation, Generation X, I think is going to be left to kind of pick up the pieces of what the baby boomers did. So how does socioeconomics view generational influence?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that's a little bit of a misnomer in terms of clearly defined generations, because there's people being born every day, and so so there's not a clear delineation between generations. I mean, we think of generations because we think of our parents. That's one generation. Our grandparents, another generation. Our kids are another generation. But I think it's much more overlapping and much more broad throughout history, but the mood of the times does have influences. I think the mood, I think, creates these trends or these conceptions of different generations, if you want to use that term, over time. For example, a negative social mood trend in the 1930s created a bear market and a depression, and it's that negative mood trend that kind of stuck with the thinking of that generation as they got older. For example, they got more conservative, and it wasn't because the depression caused them to be conservative, it's because their conservatism, which caused the depression,
sure,
stayed with them throughout as they grew up. So I think that we have common ground when we look at it in that kind of respect. And I think that, for example, the upbeat mood and the positive optimism that pervaded, say, through the 1950s and into the 60s created that bull market, which created a kind of this, optimism within that sort of quote-unquote generation. So that's kind of how we view it from a socioeconomics standpoint.
Okay, very good. One of the things that you guys talk a lot about in your publication is deflation. I'm a subscriber to that theory as well. Read a lot on Austrian economic theory. And in my book, I describe the inflation that we've had as being the size of this big blimp. And when the deflation happens, imagine all the air being let out of that blimp, right? So that's kind of a metaphor for that. But I think people in general just have default inflation expectations built into their own personal financial models. I think governments and businesses do as well. One component of that expectation is the money people expect to get from retirement plans, whether either public or private. And of course, not everyone in the private sector receives a pension. Today, after a pretty spectacular stock market and bond market run since 2009, although the bond market obviously has been turning, and you guys made that call about a year ago, many of the plans still remain underfunded. And it's interesting because I just left the session where there were a panel of like six public company representatives, and the question that I ask is, how's your pension plan doing right now? And one large company, didn't answer the question, and another one said that they were still underfunded, but they weren't concerned about it. People, I just don't think, are going to have the amount of money that they thought they were going to have. Is the underfunding of pension plans by itself a harbinger of future deflation?
I think it's a manifestation, absolutely. I think the inflation default that you first mentioned was interesting, and the reason being is because that's all people have known since they've grown up, as the kind of deflationary, depressionary people of that age get older and die off, you know, all we've really known of our age and people behind us is an inflationary bias. And that's one reason why inflation is so difficult for people to grasp and get their hands around, is because they haven't experienced it, they haven't lived it. And the only way to do that is really study history, which we've attempted to do, to look at the conditions. But yeah, I mean, we've had a tremendous run in the financial markets, or actually in the U.S. stock market in specific, over the last 4 or 5 years, and yet we still have this huge unfunded pension liability problem. I was just seeing something on the news today where New York City, I mean, is as bad in some respects as Detroit. I'm not saying New York City is going to go bankrupt like Detroit, but I'm saying they have a pension problem. They're underfunded. I think only 60% of their pensions or their future pension obligations are funded. So yes, I mean, that is a problem. That's going to be money that has to be diverted in the public sector to fund these pensions, A, number one, or number two, you're going to be giving people less than they thought they were getting. So yeah, it all feeds into the deflationary psychology that we see unfolding over the next several years or even longer, as we go from this big debt balloon to a smaller debt balloon that we're able to service through the income and the growth of our economy.
Okay. A theme also in my book, I talked a lot about the wizards. In our case, the Fed wizards, they've been pushing a lot of buttons and pulling a lot of levers, you know, the guy behind the curtain, and pretty furiously since 2008. The discount rate's at rock bottom, and the Fed balance sheet, as you know, has swelled to trillions. What button is left for them to push? What else can they do at this point?
Well, I mean, I think this is a really interesting question, the way you phrase that, because I think the fact that they've been pushing quote-unquote buttons and have gotten very little in return tells us something, and that is the Fed's not in control. The Fed does not control the markets. They don't control the economy. It's bigger than the Fed is. I mean, you said that they've been doing this furiously. They've been doing it historically. I mean, this is absolutely something that's unprecedented. Interest rates at zero for this long, a Fed balance sheet that's expanded to over $3 trillion. And yet, if you look at inflationary measures, for example, the PCE, the personal consumption expenditures, which is the Fed's favorite way of measuring inflation, and I'm going to show that in both my workshops, it's bumping along, you know, 1%. I mean, so we've had historic fiscal and monetary stimulus, but we have no inflation. Why? And that is because the forces of deflation are overwhelming the forces of inflation. And so the Fed, you know, look, the Fed dropped interest rates from 6-something% to 0%. In 2000 to 2002, and that didn't stop the NASDAQ from declining 78%. The Fed dropped interest rates all the way down to the decline from 2007 to 2008 until we got to 0%. Didn't stop the Dow from going down 58%, the largest decline since the Great Depression. Japan cut its interest rates, their central bank cut their interest rates to zero and kept them there for decades. Didn't stop the Japanese stock market from going down 80%. So there's historical evidence that the Fed does not control the markets. It's the markets that control the Fed. And I have no doubt that as the next leg of the bear market starts unfolding, they're going to try to do even more unconventional things, but it's not going to work.
So what else, and that's the reason I asked the question, what else can they do at this point? You said they might try something. I mean, they're buying mortgages, right? I mean, they're buying treasury bonds. The interest rates are at rock bottom. What other bullet can I fire?
There really isn't. And that's really, I think, when things start to accelerate on the downside, when the public realizes the central banks aren't in control, that they've thrown all this stuff out there and it's not working. I think that's when the kind of concern turns to panic, and that all feeds into a decline I think we're going to see.
And that's kind of a metaphor I use in my book, is that, you know, Toto pulls back the curtain, and then Dorothy sees the wizard for what he is.
That's
great. It's just an ordinary man, right?
Right. We've used that very same thing in our newsletter. We talked about Bernanke, the Fed being the wizard.
He's an ordinary man, and I think I agree with you. I think that at that point there's a recognition in the marketplace from people that, wow, these people we thought were orchestrating everything, they're really not.
Right, and we're starting to see that creep in. Now, I think it starts accelerating once stocks, U.S. stocks in particular, turn down. Everything else is turned down. I mean, metals are down, commodities are down, you know, oil's still down from its high, even though it's rallied recently. European markets are down. You know, the only thing that's up at new highs is U.S. stocks. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the final linchpin, and once that's pulled, then I think everything aligns itself in this next leg down.
So kind of along that line, it seems to me there's going to be a serious clash between politics and economics when governments at all levels have to consider breaking the covenants that it made with employees and citizens. In fact, you know, we have that divisiveness presently. We see that in Washington today. We talked earlier in this interview, pensions aren't going to look the same probably, and or government services will be trimmed. And we see that, obviously, that was occurring in Detroit even before the bankruptcy declaration. I was in Spain a couple of years ago in Barcelona, and you can see the very strong influence of the Catalonian region, you know, vis-a-vis the rest of the country. And I know they've had secession votes there, right? They want to split off from the rest of Spain because of some of the problems that Spain's having. I even read a book not that long ago, and the name of the book escapes me, where they were talking about political segregations, not on the old red state, blue state line that many people, but even within a city,
right?
That there's political segregations even within cities. I think sometimes that those sorts of conditions tend to foreshadow the appearance of demagogues who might seek to try to take advantage of everything. How does EWI and maybe you feel about the future political condition in the United States?
Right. That's the one thing we've talked extensively about in our newsletter and in the socionomic aspects in the socionomic newsletters, secession movements. You know, in negative social moods, you get strife and polarity, you get secession. In positive social moods, you get people coming together. For example, European Union was put together, you know, right at the top of that grand supercycle peaking process in the late 1990s. And people hailed it as such an optimistic and bullish thing that we had all these countries coming together. But the way we looked at it, it was the signal of a peak in optimism. It was after all these years of rising optimism that we finally get together and form the European Union. And that to us was the peak in optimism. And it was a sign that we were ready to reverse in a trend downward. And in fact, we have. And it's been a long, drawn-out process. We had a leg down from 2000 to 2002, big rally, couple manias, you know, within the real estate market, commodity markets, and then another leg down 2007, 2009. I think we're getting ready for another leg down. And it's during these legs down where you get these bear market and this turn in social mood, and you get strife and secession and so forth. We've written extensively about it at Socionomics Institute, how secession tends to prop up in these times. For example, the most famous time within the United States is obviously the Civil War, coming after a huge bear market that lasted from about 1830s to 1859. And it was right after the end of that big, long, drawn-out move, just as the European Union came together at the end of this long, optimistic and rising mood from, you know, the 1980s, 1990s into 2000. The Civil War came after this long, pessimistic mood from 1830s to 1859. Civil War started in the early 1860s, and we all know what happened historically there. So yeah, I mean, and there's always demagogues. There always will be demagogues, but they tend to come to popularity in bear markets when mood goes down. You know, the demagogues are there in optimistic phases and bull markets, but they're kind of marginalized or pushed aside. Sure. People don't listen to them. But in the negative social mood, that's when you tend to get a rise in these things. So that's something that we definitely need to be on the lookout and expect in the future. If we're right about our forecast and the market turns down and joins the bear market in precious metals and the bear market in commodities and the bear market in real estate, then I think you're going to see a rise in the popularity of demagogues, not demagogues themselves, but the people going to those extremes and looking at alternatives like that.
And one of the things I've had discussions with friends and associates on is maybe not so much the appearance of a demagogue per se, but maybe the need and perhaps the appearance of a strong third party. So maybe not just Republicans and Democrats anymore, but maybe there's a third party that emerges, right, to maybe add some clarity or maybe bring some sanity to the fiscal process.
The polarity within the political process will bring in a third party. And it's just a question of which way do we go, toward authoritarianism like we did in the 1930s, the bear market, or toward freedom and liberty. And it's really going to be a split in that direction. And I'm not quite
sure. That's a hard call, isn't it?
It is a call. And I'm not sure I know we don't have the answer to that. I think there's going to be elements of both. And it's just going to be interesting to see which wins out.
That to me, just from a personal perspective, is probably one of the more concerning things I have in this country, because I don't know what the answer to that is either. And I see exactly what you see, is that you could see a split, right? You could see greater elements of authority, people that want the government just to take even more charge of what's going on and exert more authority and influence, and others, perhaps like myself, maybe you, you know what, maybe let's have less of those guys and let's go back to more freedom.
Right. I mean, it's going to be, you know, whatever we want, it's going to be there. And it's just a question of which one's going to win out. And I don't know. We'll see.
So final question for Steve Hochberg, Chief Market Analyst, Elliott Wave International. Tell me what your expectations of the markets is going to be at the end of this deleveraging process, say stocks, gold, you know, long-term, short-term rates. Do you see everything basically returning back to their point of origin? And let me just use origin as, like, let's say for U.S. stocks, 1982?
Yeah. Oh, there's going to be such a tremendous buying opportunity. It's going to be the buying opportunity of our lifetime. The problem being is when we get there, no one's going to want to buy, just like no one wants to sell at the top because stocks have been rising so long, optimism's extreme. That's why we're at a high in prices. It's a very, and it's also going to be the reason why we're going to be at a low in prices, we think, you know, down the road, 2016, give or take on either side of that, is because pessimism is going to be on the increase. You know, people say, well, you know, you're bearish. You know, the world's not going to end.
Sure.
But down is just the opposite of up. I mean, you need one to have the other. You don't have sunlight 24 hours a day. You have night and then day. And a bear market is nothing but the opposite of a bull market.
And it's a cleansing process too, right?
Well, it serves as a cleansing process, and it sets the seeds up for the next great rise. But you need to get there. And I think that's what the next few years is going to portend for us. It's going to be a very, very difficult time for not only investors, but just citizens, just living. It's going to be a difficult time because of the strife, polarity, the wars, you know. And so what we're counseling our readers is just be safe. Be safe in terms of your investments. Be conservative. Be safe. Be short-term. Be safe in terms of your life and the life choices you make, because there is a tremendous buying opportunity out there, and we think it's going to present itself in the next 3, 4, 5 years, but prices are going to be a lot lower at the time, and you're not going to want to buy, but that's the time you need to step up and do it. So hopefully, you know, people will follow us as we go all the way down, and, you know, toward the end, we'll be screaming bulls, and they'll be looking at us going, are you crazy? But,
exactly.
but that's just kind of the nature of the way we look at things.
All right. Well, Steve, thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thanks.